From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Sunday, July 17th in New York City, when demonstrators gathered in front of the Indian Mission to the United Nations. They were protesting the violence that has rocked Kashmir, a part of the world that I think it is fair to say most Americans know very little about, and I am in that group. Kashmiris feel forgotten or ignored, but here's the New York Times headline, Kashmir in Chaos. Here in Rochester and on this program, you've heard the voice of Sarir Fossili, the president of the Islamic Center of Rochester. Well, he's also a Kashmiri American, and he traveled to New York to take part in that demonstration. And we have asked him to come on this program and help us understand what's going on in that region right now. There have been conflicting reports almost by the day on how many people have been killed in recent weeks in Kashmir. And there is no question that India has cracked down in various ways in the streets, and with the media in some way. So let me go ahead and welcome my guest. And as I said, Sarir Fossili is the president of the Islamic Center of Rochester. He is also a member of the board of directors of the Kashmiri American Council. Sarir, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me again.
And we're going to be talking about, I think, what's been happening in this region. Is it fair to say, Sarir, that you think most Americans, you're an American, most Americans don't know very much about Kashmir?
That is true. Most Americans aren't really aware of what's going on and has been going on in Kashmir right from 1947.
I think a lot of people, myself included, would have said, well, there's a tug of war between Pakistan and India. And other than that, you know, I don't even know how large Kashmir?
Kashmir, between the sides occupied by India and by Pakistan, totals about 13 million people. Okay, it covers a significantly large square mile area. And if you see it on any map or even a globe, you'll see it demarcated in a very specific way with dotted lines, which identify it as an internationally known place which is in dispute.
Okay, and 13 million people, but, I mean, is it Rhode Island or Texas?
it's more Texas than Rhode Island.
Okay. So let me go ahead and we're just going to pause for 1 second because I think this hour will be instructive for us. We asked Sarir to come on because I know it's an issue of passion for him, but it's one that I think that it is important for us to take a moment and try to learn about parts of the world that are in conflict. But let's get a brief moment and welcome my colleague Karen DeWitt, because as we've been doing throughout the week here, we've been allowing her to pop in and just educate us on what she is seeing. She's down at the Democratic National Convention. So before we get back to Sarir Fossili and Kashmir, Karen DeWitt on the line with us. How are you, Karen?
I'm great. I'm a part of the world that's at least in political conflict.
Yes.
Thank goodness nothing more serious than that. But yes, I'm at the center of that.
I don't think anything more serious. In fact, yesterday was supposed to be about the pacification and the unification of any factions left in the party. We have heard from some Sanders supporters who say, no way, never. But you had that moment of Bernie Sanders helping lead that roll call and the nomination of Clinton. And so now, Karen, I always hate this question, but what is the mood, what is the sentiment that you're experiencing with delegates today?
You know, some of them are going over to Hillary Clinton. You know, some of them were prepared to do that anyway. Some of them, I think, are being persuaded, and then there's a whole group of them that are not persuaded. I was at the New York delegation breakfast this morning, and most of the Bernie delegates that were there yesterday, they just didn't show up. It's almost like they've moved on. I don't know if they went home or they're finding other more interesting things to do from their point of view at the convention, but they're not really part of the mainstream New York Democratic Party, and, you know, they probably didn't really feel like they really fit in there anyway. So I think there's a whole mix of feelings there, and, Bernie Sanders is continuing, speaking at more breakfasts, not at New York this morning, but at other ones, to try to pull his people in. But there's only so much, I think, that he can do, because he, in all his speeches, he'd always say, it's not about me. You guys are the movement. So you can't suddenly tell people, oh, well, I don't want you to do this anymore. And I think he knows that.
Karen, what are your plans for the rest of the day? Why don't you tell us what's coming up here in terms of your coverage?
Well, following Governor Cuomo around, it's day two. He kind of keeps changing his schedule around. I'm not really sure why. Cuomo was supposed to speak at today's breakfast, and they moved the breakfast up an hour early, and then he didn't speak at the breakfast, and now he's at a lunch for President Bill Clinton, and he's going to be speaking publicly at a labor group in, just about an hour and a half, and then going down to the convention hall. We still don't know when he is going to speak. We know his kind of frenemy, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, got a spot 4:30 today, which isn't the best spot, but it's a spot. Governor Cuomo's angling for a spot tomorrow. But I'll tell you, these speaker lists are so jam-packed with people. It's like hard to see how they're even going to squeeze them in. But I suppose he feels like he is close to the Clintons, and they do owe him this. So we'll see. I'll try to find out a little more information about that later in an hour or so when we see him.
All right, Karen, and one more question for you. You know, NPR reported this morning they had an interview with Julian Castro, and they made the point that these conventions sometimes serve to position future party leaders. You know, they are platforms. Obviously, Obama 2004, Julian Castro got a prime slot in 2012. You know, I don't know that someone from the New York delegation is in that group that the party currently views as ascendant. I don't know if Andrew Cuomo ever wants it. I don't know that it could ever happen for him. Do you get the sense that there's anyone in the delegation right now that is viewed by the DNC as a future party leader?
Well, if you count Senate Majority Leader, we have Chuck Schumer, which...
But he's not going to be on a national ticket.
Hoping, but yeah. But other than that, no. Andrew Cuomo, he's not speaking at other delegation breakfasts. He's really pretty much low profile around here, I would say, relatively, considering how many hundreds and thousands of people there are. No, I would say before, 4 years ago, he was viewed more as a possible presidential candidate, but not right now, no.
And Kirsten Gillibrand, I think she had a chance to speak briefly, but, not in prime time. She had, a couple of years ago, a run of publicity in a number of different places, and certainly she's still serving as senator. Have you seen much of her?
Mm-hmm. She did give a speech to the delegates. She's kind of low-key in her speeches,
yeah.
So frankly, a lot of people were talking. These delegates, they don't tolerate boredom all that well, I guess. But she's very popular, and she's a very good politician. And, her chance could come, and she's young, too. So, her chance could come in a decade. Who knows? I mean, I think she certainly would be somebody to be considered.
Well, Karen, I used to think that nobody could be later to regularly scheduled political events than George Pataki. Then I met Chuck Schumer, and it is really remarkable. But if Andrew Cuomo's schedule is changing, it's probably because they're trying to give you the slip. I know you will find them. I know you will track them.
We definitely will. It's a big town, but we'll hunt them down.
As always, good to talk to you this week. Thanks for covering the convention for us, and we'll talk to you again.
Absolutely. It's been fun.
Karen DeWitt reporting from Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention. And again, of course, she was in Cleveland last week, Philadelphia this week, reporting on the events for us there. And let me turn back now to Sarir Fazlollah. We're going to be talking about his work as a member of the board of directors of the Kashmiri American Council. But just one question, whether he wants it or not, as president of the Islamic Center of Rochester, I know you're following the events of the election. I suspect you have to be as apolitical as you can in that role in Rochester, or is it now almost impossible for you to be apolitical?
Well, from an official standpoint, the Islamic Center of Rochester takes no position on either of the candidates, and whomever our membership chooses to vote for, more power to them. It is difficult as a Muslim to say that we understand or respect some of the rhetoric coming from the Republican nominee, Mr. Trump. I'm sure there may be people who find something appealing about him and some of the things that he's done and said. I have my limitations and restrictions of that. But from an official standpoint, we do not take sides in this matter.
Okay. I think that's enough said, and plenty to read between the lines. So now let's shift to his work as a member of the board of directors of the Kashmiri American Council. And the reason that I asked him to come in here is because there is so much conflict in this part of the world, Kashmir, that most of us just don't know very much about. You mentioned that there's 13 million people in Kashmir, and on a map, it's between India and Pakistan. It's sort of been a long disputed kind of a territory. Give me a sense for the geography, the land, the beauty of Kashmir. What is it like?
The beauty of Kashmir is unrivaled. They say it's the Switzerland of the subcontinent. Kashmir itself is in a valley, and it is in the foothills of the Himalayas. There are, as I said, there's approximately 87,000 square miles that cover the parts that are occupied by both of the countries. Kashmir has historically been stuck in between. I wish I could describe the beauty of it, but it was one of the one of the Mughal emperors on his deathbed who said that if there was beauty anywhere, it was in Kashmir. We have seen since 1947, Kashmir is the oldest book, is the oldest unfinished business on the books of the United Nations. Up until 1947, when India and Pakistan each got their independence from the British, Kashmir was essentially an independent territory. And it was at the independence of India and Pakistan that the Maharaja of Kashmir at the time decided to join or try to join the Indian country at the time. There were lots of protests against that because this was until then it had been a free place. And there was a war between India and Pakistan that the United Nations ultimately stepped in with resolutions saying that there had to be a plebiscite, a vote of the people, plain and simple, to decide Kashmir's ultimate sovereignty.
And again, when was that?
That was in 1947.
Okay.
Resolutions were in 1948.
And then what happened?
Thereafter, there were steps and starts towards doing that to the extent that a United States admiral, Admiral Chester Nimitz, was actually appointed the plebiscite administrator in Kashmir. Unfortunately, Kashmir became one of the victims of the Cold War. And any time there was supposed to be some movement forward on it, the Russians and the Indians would conspire to slow it down and stop it. It got to a point where a separate article in the Indian Constitution, is known as Article 370, after India had usurped the Kashmiri rights, had essentially said that Kashmir would have autonomy under the Indian Constitution, where India would only control its currency, foreign affairs, and defense. Well, this was something that was totally opposite to what the UN had promised, and the Kashmiri people didn't ever accept. As a result, there was continued alienation between the Kashmiris and India. India always put its own stooges into the seat of power in Kashmir, and it took us to where we are essentially today. The idea of Kashmir being a part of India as a country was foreign to Kashmiris back in the 40s, and it's foreign to them today. In fact, it was July of 1931, where the first step, one of the first steps of Kashmiri so-called independence at that time from an autocratic ruler started the Quit Kashmir movement. So the idea of Kashmir and its history being part of India is extremely foreign to anybody who reads history.
Do Kashmiris currently feel sort of ignored or forgotten?
Kashmiris have been ignored. They don't have oil, unfortunately, and there is very little in the interests of some of the much stronger powers to really take an active role in it. India is a mighty power, economically and otherwise, and people will tend to ignore things that the powerful do if they find some ultimate or possible benefit to the same. There are UN resolutions on the books of the UN asking and commanding that Kashmir have a plebiscite. Because there is nothing that a Kashmiri has to offer in terms of those resources, they're being ignored. Kashmiris have stood up for themselves. They have tried to take back the rights that were taken from them. They started an indigenous armed rebellion against illegal Indian occupation that started in about 1988 or 1989, and militancy was prevalent in Kashmir. India used every form of reprisal against them.
They crushed it, didn't they?
They did their best to crush it. Yeah. They crushed, what they were able to do was take a big chunk out of the military aspect of the Kashmiri uprising. What they did was they sent in more army, border security forces, Central Reserve Police forces. It is unparalleled. The highest amount of occupational forces anywhere in the world are Indian forces and troops in Kashmir. There are over 700,000 military and paramilitary forces occupying Kashmir. There is one armed soldier from India for almost every 8 to 10 Kashmiri civilians.
It doesn't sound like it's that disputed. I mean, I think a lot of Americans, if they know anything at all about Kashmir, think of it as this tug of war between Pakistan and India, and it sounds like India has the control right now.
India controls a significant portion of Kashmir. Pakistan controls a portion as well. When we talk about control, however, you're talking about control of the mighty over the weak. There is no military power that may be able to wrest India, that may be able to wrest Kashmir away from India or Pakistan. However, what they have been unable to crush is the spirit and the desire of the Kashmiri people for their freedom, for their rights. Over time, the government of India has taken over areas that otherwise they were not allowed to, whether that was their Supreme Court decisions having sway over the local courts in Kashmir, their income tax authorities having control, being able to levy taxes and the like. So step by step, they have been able to remove the alleged autonomy that they single-handedly granted over the objections of the Kashmiris. But the Kashmiris themselves, if you look today and if you look at what history has shown, they have always exhibited an unambiguous stand for wanting to determine their own fate and be free.
Here is a letter to the New York Times from a Kashmiri published just a few days ago. Quote, Nawaz Sharif, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, said on July 22nd, we are waiting for the day when Kashmir becomes part of Pakistan. Sushma Swaraj, the Minister of External Affairs in India, said on July 23rd, the whole of Jammu and of Kashmir belongs to India. Kashmiris wish to emphasize that their land is not real estate that can be parceled out between India and Pakistan, but the home of a nation with a history far more compact and coherent than India's and far longer than Pakistan's. No settlement of their status will hold unless it is explicitly based on the principles of self-determination and gives the people the choice whether to join India or join Pakistan, or remain independent, end quote. You agree with that?
Absolutely. This is not a border dispute between India and Pakistan. That's how people would like to see it and how people are characterizing it. In fact, too many times people say that whatever the troubles are, let the two governments work it out. This is not about that. This is about, as I stated, over 13 million people's right to self-determination to decide where they want to go.
Which they were promised decades ago.
Which they have been promised, and it was reaffirmed in subsequent resolutions at the UN. As I said, the U.S. Retired Admiral Chester Nimitz had been appointed as the plebiscite administrator. What we are simply asking, we're not asking for anything other than, A, what was promised, and B, what the people's rights are. No more and no less. And thereafter, if the people decide to go to India or to Pakistan, God bless them. However, their decision has to be given unmitigated respect. And there is a significant number of Kashmiris who would prefer a third option or that of independence.
We're talking to Sarir Fasili, who is a member of the board of directors of the Kashmiri American Council. And I see the phone ringing. If you have any questions about the subject, I certainly do. I suspect you do as well. We're trying to learn as much as we can about conflict in this part of the world that is often uncovered, or at least not covered nearly as much as others. You can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Here's the New York Times editorial in which they are calling out Indian leadership. This is the New York Times just a few days ago. Quote, the use of force by security forces, including censorship, communications blackouts, are unworthy of India's democracy. Unworthy, according to the New York Times, what India has been doing with security forces, the use of force, censorship, communications blackouts, the impact on media. They're saying it's unworthy of Indian democracy. Now, Sarir, you're a Kashmiri American. Where were you born?
I was born in Hackensack, New Jersey.
Hackensack, New Jersey. Now you live in Rochester, but you have family and friends in Kashmir.
I have many family and many friends in Kashmir.
And can you go there? Can you travel there?
I have been lucky enough to be able to visit. Many people in my shoes have not been granted visas to visit Kashmir because they have to pass through New Delhi, and in order to go to Kashmir, you have to have an Indian visa. Many people I know do not have a visa. I have one. It does not prevent the visa being revoked the first time I step in New Delhi if need be. You talked about the New York Times editorial talking about the censorship. The most recent uprising, approximately 20 days ago, a young man who was an avowed and admitted militant who had taken arms to fight against Indian occupation was known, his name was Burhan Wani. And he's a young guy at age 15. Some of these occupational forces stop him and his brother and their buddy, and they send them to go and buy cigarettes for them. So like all these guys would do, these are the armed forces telling us, they went, they came back, gave them cigarettes. They still got beaten up. In fact, this guy's brother, Burhan, was really beaten up severely. At that point, Burhan says, I'm ultimately going to take revenge. His brother is ultimately killed. Burhan goes off and joins alleged militancy. Because he's so young and is socially social network aware, he starts posting on Facebook and other places calls for the youth to join him to remove the Indian occupation. And amongst his themes are this thing known as Kashmiriyat, or respect for all of the minorities. There is an annual pilgrimage called the Amarnath Yatra, where Hindus come to Kashmir every year and go to a specific place and pay their obeisance to a shrine. He was very clear. He said Kashmiris have historically never raised their hands or given anything other than protection to the minorities. That's going to stay the same. That'll never change for us. Similarly, our only issue and gripe is with the occupational forces. Even the Jammu and Kashmir policemen should think twice about raising their hand against us because they have become a part of the repression in Kashmir. When he died, he was ultimately killed. Some say he was killed in a custodial killing. Others say it was in so-called battle.
Gun battle, yeah.
A gun battle. There's no evidence indicating that he even ever raised his gun towards the Indians. Rather, he may have used it just as a way to show his support. Over 200 to 300,000 people wanted to go to his funeral prayer, and they were prevented from marching towards his town or even driving there. So there were funeral prayers held in absentia in many different towns and cities across Kashmir. There were tremendous protests, tens of thousands of people wanting to take to the streets.
This is all in the last several weeks.
This is all in the last
couple of months,
20 days.
Okay.
And in response, the Indian forces were out on the street. They were firing live ammunition. And what the papers are reporting as pellets are actually ball bearings. There have been over 50 deaths. There have been over 150 eye injuries, children as young as 5 years old. And there have been over 3,000 injured. And those still, their eyesight is to be determined. India also, what they did is, they stopped the presses. In the middle of the night one night, newspapers are raided by policemen. Their printing plates are taken away. Some of their staff were arrested, and everything got shut down. Mobile phones and even many landlines, other than one carrier, everything else has been shut off. So we have been unable to communicate with our loved ones, say, hey, what's going on? All we know is that somehow some of the papers are able to upload electronically, which they have, and a little bit of news comes out. However, many, many phones, tens of thousands of people are even without mobile service. People studying abroad cannot call home and ask their parents about how they're doing or feeling, if they even have bread and water to eat and drink, or even to send money for tuition and other things, because there is absolutely no connectivity. Some of those were eased as recently as yesterday, at least publicly, but from a practical standpoint, there was no signal on those phones.
Are you able to get through to your family and loved ones?
We have spoken to a couple, yes. We have been able to speak to some of them, because a lot of it depends on who their carrier is, as far as how they get either their phone or their cell service. So a lot of that is what that depended on.
Let me grab our first phone call, and this is Dan in Brighton. I'm with Sarir Fosli. Go ahead, Dan.
All right, do Kashmiris have their own language? And the second question is, why hasn't it created as much of a fuss as, say, justice for the Palestinians has in this country, with boycotts and all sorts of stuff?
Dan, thank you for the phone call. First question, do Kashmiris have their own language, sir?
Yes, Kashmiris speak Kashmiri. It is a language indigenous to the land. They also speak Urdu, which is commonly spoken in Pakistan. However, Kashmiri has, we speak Kashmiri in Kashmir also, and it does have its own language.
Can you?
I can, not as well as I might like to, having okay. been born and raised here, but I can communicate. And when I do go to Kashmir, I am able to make my way without much trouble. Yes.
Okay. His other question was, why haven't we seen a movement akin to support for Palestinians?
I think the issue, it's a great question, and we often ask ourselves the same thing. The Palestinian issue is almost pan-Arab because all of the Arab countries had a stake or a say in what was going on with the Palestinians. The Palestinians were literally physically pushed out from their land. And whether it was done in connivance with the world leaders or what have you, their issues have taken on a greater thing based on the fact that there's been a lot of war over there as well. There have been many human rights abuses. The whole idea of so-called terrorism emanated from that. So while we see this as the same issue, the fact that the Palestinian issue and the Israeli issue, while it's a political one, is also one of Arabs in general. And one of the main similarities is that the UN has spoken on both of these issues very, very close. Palestinian issue goes back to 48, Kashmir 47. Unfortunately, the loss of life and property and dignity for both the Palestinians and the Kashmiris is still falling on deaf ears.
I mentioned the New York Times editorial condemning some of the actions of the Indian government in relation to Kashmiris and these recent weeks. They're not the only ones. We've seen other voices and other media in parts of Europe, around the world. And I kind of kept going back to a very ignorant question, but the first time Sarir and I were talking about this, I brought it up, and I'll just ask you again here. India is a nation of more than a billion people? How many people, Sarir, in India?
Easily over a billion.
Okay, over a billion people. And Kashmir is 13 million people. It's not nothing, but what is the value to India? I'm not saying Kashmir doesn't have value, but I'm saying do you need to continue to occupy a place with 13 million people who want that autonomy that they were sort of promised decades ago and once had? If the only way to maintain that relationship is occupation, what does India get? Why did they do this?
This is a matter of pride. If India can't have it, Pakistan is definitely not getting it. And it serves as a buffer. It's the border state between India and Pakistan. They have been at war or daggers drawn right from the days of independence. So
With Pakistan.
Okay. So the idea that they would want to be able to hold Kashmir by force is significant in its national defense strategy. The other thing to think about is Kashmir in and of itself has tremendous natural resources. The water resources that Kashmir has, it is said by some of the experts, could provide power to the whole of India and Pakistan. Okay? There was a professor from Hawaii who spoke at a conference I was at, and he said, the next war between India and Pakistan, with all due respect, isn't going to be about Kashmir or land or whatever. It's going to be about the water, because the water needs of 1.8 or 9 billion people in the subcontinent are obviously significant.
Particularly with climate change.
Absolutely. So it's not just that. The natural resources, once upon a time, the highest amount of foreign exchange that India would take in, it was said, would come from Kashmir and its tourism. Because prior to the trouble starting or restarting in 1989 and 90, Kashmir was flooded with tourists, all from the outside. Many Indians would come, obviously, also. However, Europeans, Americans, etc., they would go to Kashmir in droves. And in the Indian subcontinent, when it's so hot in the balance of India, people would come to Kashmir in the summer and they would vacation. So you have a place that brings so much in terms of economic resources that it's incredible. Kashmir could be a net exporter of some of the finest silks, some of the finest carpets in the world come from Kashmir. Produce, apples by the droves and droves. And of course, as I said, the water. And with the tourism being what it is an incredible asset to have. And until now, that has been choked.
A listener named Alan emailed to ask, does Kashmir come from Kashmir?
Kashmir does not directly come from Kashmir, but up very, very high in the mountains, this animal which produces the Kashmir material is known to come from there. However, people may have heard of something called the ring shawl, where a shawl is so fine and so delicate that it is able to pass without catching any of its fibers through, say, a wedding ring. That's known as pashmina. That comes from Kashmir.
Let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back to your phone calls. I see the phone ringing. Sarir Fazali is my guest. He's the president of the Islamic Center of Rochester, and he's a member of the board of directors of the Kashmiri American Council. He's a Kashmiri American, and we're talking about what's going on in Kashmir, this conflict that has become so violent in recent weeks, and we're trying to learn as much as we can. Short break, and more with him next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, in our first hour, the plagiarism that was in Melania Trump's speech has sparked a discussion among teachers across the country. Teachers view this as a chance to talk to students about the perils of plagiarism, and we'll talk about that first hour. Then, second hour, our Summer of Food series of conversations continues with a talk about cider and activism. Talk to you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get to some of your phone calls about this issue. And next up is John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, my question for your guest is, India, do you think there a lot of this has to do, they want a more of a buffer zone against Islamic terrorists? I know they've been a victim of many terrorist attacks over the last decade. And I see that as they want a neutral area, maybe as a buffer, similar to the Israel has with the West Bank and the Palestinian region.
Okay, John, stay on the line. Go ahead, Sarir.
What I can say about this idea of terrorism, I'm going to go back to the days of partition, August 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th of 1947. India and Pakistan get their independence, and they immediately split. The rioting that took place at that time, as people were literally picking sides and going here and there, choosing between India and Pakistan, is unrivaled. Hundreds and thousands of people were butchered in those riots. There was one place that had nothing but communal sanctity, and that has been quoted by nobody less than Mohandas K. Gandhi. And that was Kashmir. Not a single episode of any communal violence ever occurred in Kashmir. That day to this day, the idea of there being so-called Islamic terrorism, however somebody chooses to define that, and as a result, that somehow allowing or enabling India to hold a land and its people by force, respectfully, there is no continuity between those schools of thought. There has not been terrorism in Kashmir. Has there been violence and has there been uprising? Absolutely. And have various parties tried to take advantage of that one way or other? There's no doubt about it. In fact, when the most recent uprising started again in 1990, India sent a person by the name of Jagmohan. He goes by one name, and as a governor of Kashmir. And what he did is, over the course of 17 straight days, he arranged for the exodus of the Kashmiri Pandit or Hindu minority, arranged trucks and buses, etc., for them to pack up and move out. It was his plan to really unleash mayhem in Kashmir against the Muslim majority population, kind of quote-unquote calm things down and show people how serious he was. And then the expectation was that the minority community would return. What he did was paint this out as a so-called terrorism thing and tried to paint the whole ethnic cleansing, use it as an ethnic cleansing brush. That never worked. And what he did was he created refugees from Kashmir within India, because now those people, they have not returned, though there has been a cry for them to return, not just from their community, but by ours, by the Kashmiri Muslim community, saying, please make them come back. They should come back. We welcome them with open arms. Not in little enclaves or little hamlets, but where they traditionally lived, they won't have any problems. There is a reasonable number of Kashmiri Pandits and Hindus who stayed in Kashmir.
Well, how do you draw the line between, you mentioned violence and not equaling terrorism? India might have a different definition of that.
Absolutely. That's what they say. One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. However, when you see how India had usurped Kashmiri rights right from 1947, and Kashmiris in 1987 united under the banner, under a political banner, to face off against the traditional rulers that India had foisted upon them in Kashmir in elections. India rigged those elections through the connivance of the local government that was in power at the time in Kashmir and from India. And when the Kashmiris realized they're not even letting, you know, playing fair with us through our elections, not to mention anything else, they were left with no choice but to try to take their rights forcefully. So if somebody says that it's terror, they can say it. This is as indigenous as it comes. And the indigenous Kashmiri militant groups, however you choose to define them, have not been labeled as terrorists by any international organization.
Let me get Sam and Webster next. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I'm an Indian. I work here. And I have actually a lot of Kashmiri friends. And I was hoping that you would have somebody to present like the Indian point of view, because I know for sure that a lot of the things which the caller, which the speaker is speaking about has a counterpoint. So it would be a more balanced argument that if you would have somebody who had an who would say things from the point of view of Indians.
Well, Sam, I would just say, listen, I take that point. Stay on the line. I take that point. I'm trying to learn as much as I can here, and I understand the point. My goal is to present something that is hopefully educational for a subject that most of us don't know much about. But I am certainly open to, as we go forward, to continuing this discussion. And if you want to add now, feel free. Go ahead.
So I just had another question. This is now coming to like real politics. Even suppose India gives Kashmir complete independence, there is no way that Pakistan is going to let things go without any interference. They have done that in Afghanistan. You know how things worked out with Taliban. And the previous caller is right. I mean, I'm 100% definite that even if Kashmir is given independence, Pakistan is going to try to influence it, and it's just going to end up as, you know, another Afghanistan. And my second point is that India is a democratic country. I agree that they have done some bad things to Kashmiris, but the future of Kashmir is 100 times better with India than with Pakistan. I don't know why they would want to go with Pakistan.
Sam, can I ask you
something like autonomy? That would be like better for both of them.
Sam, I just want to ask you a couple questions, and then I'm just going to get out of the way and let Sarir and you have a conversation. But you're presenting this as sort of this binary. It's India or Pakistan. And Kashmiris are saying, hold on. Hold up for 1 second, because again, I'm as ignorant as anybody on this subject. You're presenting this as a binary, that without Indian influence, it will be Pakistan. Pakistan will not be able to sort of honor autonomy in Kashmir, and therefore Kashmiris are much better off under the Indian influence, and that's why India is holding Kashmir under its thumb, because it is still better for Kashmir than Pakistan. Why are we giving up on the notion of autonomy?
That's a pretty good way of putting it. I think like Kashmir is like a jewel. It's a very good place, and it has immense strategic importance to both India and Pakistan. And you could talk to any national security advisor or anybody. There is no way that Pakistan is going to just say that, okay, we give up on Kashmir, let them be independent. That's not how the real world works. It's never going to happen. I mean, it didn't happen in Afghanistan even after U.S. troops were there. I mean, they still continue to fund Taliban. And, I mean, that's in spite of the U.S. troops being there, that Pakistan spy agencies are kind of like still creating trouble in Afghanistan. We'll be nuts to think that, you know, if Kashmir is just left by itself, there is not going to do anything over there.
Okay.
There's no way, I mean.
All right, Sam, stay there.
I won't buy it.
Sariri says Pakistan's not going to lay off. It's not going to happen.
You know, with due respect to the caller and to everybody else, the fear or the concern should not be what Pakistan is going to do, what India is going to do, etc. The first step in this process is what is best for the Kashmiris by and for and through the Kashmiris. If a Kashmiri population decides that they want option A, B, or C, that has to be respected. And I think it's incumbent upon us, especially those of us living here in America, who exercise all of the same rights that the Kashmiris are striving and dying for. We can pick up a ballot. We vote our conscience or not anytime. We have the freedom to read or not read a newspaper or speak, etc. That's what these people want. And it's not a question of autonomy, because that is apparently what both countries are claiming exist already in Kashmir. This is a question of the possible independence of the land from both India and Pakistan. And that's a very important thing. The spy agencies for Kashmir, for Pakistan, and especially for India, are very, very active. There's no doubt about it. They've been at war for, you know, the better part of 60 years now. So to hold Kashmir as a hostage based on what somebody may or may not do, respectfully, it cannot be the seminal question here. That has to be, you know, everybody's national security interests can and would be reasonably met with an independent Kashmir.
Sam, it does sound a little paternalistic to say, listen, Pakistan won't leave you alone. We know what's good for you. You have to stay with us, when the notion of independence is out there and has been for decades. I mean, maybe it's idealistic, but do you understand why Kashmiris would feel that idealism that says, you know, don't tell us what's good for us because you know how Pakistan will react?
Are you speaking to me?
Yes, go ahead.
I tell you once again, I mean, it'll be a great world if everybody can live happily, but the nature of the things is that that's not how it is. I mean, we try to create liberal democracy in Libya, it failed. In Iraq, it failed. I mean, everywhere you've tried, it's failed. I mean, it'll be great if they can live, if everybody will be happy, but it's never going to happen. I mean, I just tell what happened in Afghanistan. I mean, Pakistan kind of like still messed in its internal affairs. And the second point is that, like, that's why I wanted that there could be some Indian person who could tell in more detail. But Indians don't treat Kashmiris that bad. I have Kashmiri friends. I mean, all the Kashmiri friends I know, I mean, they were Muslims and they came to study in engineering colleges in India and everything was fine. I mean, there's no discrimination. There is some heavy-handedness from the security forces. But, I mean, what are you going to do if a bunch of terrorists is mixed with a general population? It's going to happen everywhere. I mean, U.S. inadvertently also kills innocent people in Afghanistan or in Iraq. But that's not because it wants to do it, but it's because the terrorists are kind of like mixed in with the general population.
All right,
so,
Sam.
I think the we have to see what is realistic. I mean, realistically speaking, after seeing what has happened in the world and now in all the countries, I don't think there is any chance that, you know, Kashmir is going to be independent without any external influences from both India and Pakistan. I mean, it's just not going to happen.
Sam, thank you, first of all, for the phone call. Second of all, thank you for, I think, the continued urging to continue this conversation. I knew that Sarir had gone to New York City during that demonstration outside the United Nations. I asked him to come in and share the experience. Will you come back and we'll broaden the discussion in future panels?
Every and any time I can.
Okay. Because Sam, you're right, and I appreciate that. Now, on Sam's last points there, Sarir, he said, the Indians are not treating Kashmiris that bad, that sometimes the security forces are heavy-handed. But he's disputing this notion that Kashmiris are not being treated well, despite what I've seen reported in the New York Times and many other places. What would you say to that?
As somebody who lives in America, I was in Kashmir last year in August.
Okay.
The presence of the Indian occupational forces is everywhere. They're on the streets, they're in the barracks, they're in the towns, they are everywhere. And I generally confine myself to some of the major cities and towns. I have not gone to some of the villages. I'll tell you what fair treatment is. An octogenarian, a gentleman over 80 years old who is surviving on probably half of a kidney, his name is Sayyid Ali Shah Gilani. He is a Kashmiri resistance leader. He has been under house arrest for about the last 4 or 5 years. I'm not talking about days or weeks, years. Muhammad Yassin Malik is another political resistance leader. Previously was one of the architects and one of the persons who started the armed uprising in 1995. He was jailed. He left militancy. He said, we have to do this peacefully. He has been jailed for the last 3 to 4 weeks.
But perhaps India views him as a terrorist.
Perhaps. However, when the trouble dies down, he is out. He's not jailed. He's not anything. The moment that there is any issue because he speaks, they jail him. Mirwais Muhammad Umar Farooq, his father was assassinated in this back in 1990. He is known as one of the religious figureheads of Kashmir. He's my age. He's about mid-40s. He has been under house arrest for the last 18 days. He leads a large segment of the population, and he gives a sermon every Friday in the largest, grandest mosque in the city of Srinagar, the capital of Kashmir. That mosque has been chained and padlocked for the last 2 or 3 Fridays. He has been under house arrest. This is how India is treating those who are advocating for peaceful resistance. These leaders have said, protest, march, raise slogans, do not raise violence, do not disturb government property or personal property. However, make sure you are heard. In the last 3 weeks, public outside the canteens, in the hospitals where there have been so many injured, so many people who were brought without even people who could help them, attendants or family members, the people living in those areas, they have provided them food and drinks and a place to rest because they had nobody else with them. There is no question that India has abused. Their human rights record in Kashmir is not even poor. It's not even something to speak of. It's not because I say so. It's because the human rights champions like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, even the U.S. State Department puts out an annual report on human rights violations and the countries. It's a country-specific report. It has consistently taken India to task about its human rights record in Kashmir. As a Kashmiri, I can say there is no fairness or even reasonable treatment for a Kashmiri in Kashmir or otherwise.
All right, back to the phones. And in this is in Rochester. This is Sudhir. Go ahead, yeah, Sudhir.
I just wanted to talk about a few things. My point, number one, is the gentleman had suggested that there was no communal violence right from 1947 right up to 1990. I am basically a Kashmiri myself, living in India now in U.S. for the last 17 odd years. Imagine a condition where you are in, say, living in a city, you live in Rochester, and somebody says, hey, get out of this place. Do you think it's even possible for a person, say, 100,000 odd people, to leave a place just because security forces are telling you to? Will you leave your own place? I'm first asking you, I don't think you are going to leave your own house just because some security forces are telling you to leave the place. So somebody is telling you that there was no communal violence and we just made, it was done by somebody who was from the Indian government. Don't you think that is absurd?
Sarir, start with that. And we're down to about our last 3 minutes, so let's have a conversation here. Go ahead, Sarir.
Absolutely. And I respect Sudhir's position. But when over a continuous period of 17 to 18 days, a minority group as large as is being described by the caller is able to get up and leave, in fact, leaving their keys to some of their possessions in the hands of their Muslim neighbors, okay? It's not my reporting. I'm going back to 1990 and numerous press reports. These are the stories that are told by the Kashmiris as well as by some of the human rights organizations. There is no doubt that it was an orchestrated plan to get them out of Kashmir.
Okay, Sudhir?
So you mean to say suddenly 300,000 people will say, okay, let me go with those security forces they are telling me to. It's a good opportunity.
With respect to the number of 300,000...
It might be more. So let's say 100,000. Let's make it 50,000. Whatever number you choose.
There is a minority that stayed in Kashmir. They're still there.
They're still there, and can you give the number? There's about 8,000 people from that I know.
And in fact, most recently, God bless them, one of them or a couple of them passed away, and it was their Muslim neighbors, even in these last 2 weeks under continuous curfew, performed their last funeral rites. So there is still a minority there that has stayed and been not only looked after, because Kashmiris have been very neighborly and brotherly to them.
Does the number 8,000 seem more or less correct?
But have taken care of that population. I don't have, unfortunately, the most recent 2016 numbers of how many of the minority are still there. I would say it's significantly higher than 8,000.
Okay. Whatever number you choose, I will again let you choose that number. But basically, it's good to let the viewers, the people who are hearing this know that those are the people who are actually in some government jobs who won't be able to go to any other job. So those people are literally forced to be there.
Okay, go ahead, Sarir.
Whether they were, you know, employed by the government or privately or what have you, you know, I cannot say that all X number of the Kashmiri minority population that stayed back through economic reasons. I would disagree with the caller. There are plenty of people there that are retired and that were not employed in government service that stayed. But the motivation for those that fled or left was not from a genuine fear of what was or was not happening. It was through an orchestrated plot to get them out.
20 seconds. Is this dividing the Islamic community that you're helping serve as president of the center?
No. In the Islamic Center of Rochester, neither I nor any of my friends talk politics while we are doing the Islamic Center's work. I have friends from Pakistan. I have friends from India. Of course, I have friends from Kashmir. They know me as the Kashmiri, and we are able to tease each other and have proper conversations and discussions about the issues, but does it disturb the work we do? Absolutely not.
You can see there are still many questions, and I do hope you'll come back, and we will broaden the discussion, and we are trying to learn and be open-minded. And Sarir, thank you for being here this hour.
Thank you again.
Sarir Fazli is not only the president of the Islamic Center of Rochester, he's a member of the board of directors of the Kashmiri American Council. And again, thanks for the questions, and I promise this conversation will continue. In fact, thanks for all of the feedback both hours today. From the entire staff here at Connections, I'm Evan Dawson, and we'll talk to you on Thursday.